Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. Tonight's episode of Chasing Earhart contains content that might not be suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is advised. On the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan vanished over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. Now, 82 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be pieced together. Welcome to Season 2 of Chasing Earhart.
Who doesn't love a good story? Being in Navy intelligence, that's what led me to find a story about Amelia Earhart that no one had ever heard about. This is Amelia Earhart meets Lost. My name is Guy Knopfsinger. I'm a 22-year veteran of the U.S. Navy.
Here's an opportunity to set the record straight.
It's critical that we get to the truth and that we rewrite the history books.
If you guys can take down Pablo Escobar, you can solve this mystery too.
This is a new adventure, and this is something that I think we can accomplish with the skills that we have joined with you.
This just parallels what we did back then. We're gonna have to unravel all the secrets that exist.
President Roosevelt was known for being a massive collector of intelligence. Vincent Astor, Charles Lindbergh, Amelia Earhart. He had them out there using their own cover stories to find intelligence that he couldn't get from anyone else. There are articles published with her at Kodak looking at cameras that were going to be installed on her airplane. Why would you put a camera on your airplane? There is evidence that her plan all along was to photograph secret Japanese facilities. The Hawaii Clipper was Pan Am's gem of the sky. On July 29th, 1938, the Hawaii Clipper was taxiing out into the bay. Inside the plane were $3 million in gold banknotes. We have everything we need to prove that FDR sent the Hawaii Clipper with $3 million on board to bring her back home.
And that's equivalent to how much in today's
currency? $56
million. $56 million was $56. On that plane. That's a lot of money.
Members of the crew told their family, we're on a secret mission to get the flying lady.
One of the pilots, his daughter, told me that they were on a mission to rescue A.E., to rescue Amelia Earhart. I did 30 years with the Drug Enforcement Administration, and then we can tell who's lying, who's not lying. There's no doubt in my mind that she's telling the truth. There were supposedly two guys that were hiding in the tail. To me, that is really important.
Two men who they thought were Filipino flight mechanics stowed away in the back of the plane. Now they believe they were actually Japanese agents. And those two men took it over halfway through its flight at gunpoint and flew it to Truk Lagoon.
Oh, now we've got two guys hijacking the plane. Why?
At the time, the Japanese are building the A6M Zero. It doesn't have the speed or the capacity to carry a full bomb load from a carrier attack to Pearl Harbor. This engine can get them there.
You know, the fact that two of aviation's greatest mysteries could be connected, this could be monumental. This is an angle we haven't even considered until now.
We've reached the final time that we'll be discussing theory on this podcast. It's been a long road, but we wanted to wrap with fresh faces, new ideas, and a twist on this story that you'll never see coming. If you're familiar with this podcast or with vanished Amelia Earhart, you've likely heard of the Hawaii Clipper. But you might not know its fate. And no one listening would ever know that that fate is tied in with the woman we've been discussing for 79 episodes of our show. Tonight, we go out on a bang on this The Go Home episode of Chasing Earhart, as we're joined via Zoom by Guy Knopfsinger, Jeff Riegel, and Jim Janicki of Expedition 5 to discuss the lost Clipper and the search to find its 15-member passengers and crew, and why that flight was in fact on a rescue mission to bring back none other than Amelia Earhart. With just two more episodes of the Chasing Earhart podcast remaining, perhaps it's fitting that we leave you with one final theory episode. Now, we've covered a lot around here in the last 3 years, but tonight, I promise you we're going to leave you with one of the most amazing stories that you will ever hear. Joining me via Zoom is Guy Knopfsinger, Jeff Riegel, and Jim Janicki, and together we're going to tell you a story that the world isn't ready to believe. Gentlemen, this is a pleasure. Welcome to Chasing Earhart.
Thanks so much. Wow.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right. So before we get into it, let's get an idea of your education, your professional background, so we can have a little foundation for where all this is going to come from tonight. And I'll start with you, of course, Guy. Give us a little about your education and your professional background, please, sir.
Thanks so much, Chris. And I'm really excited to be here. And thank you for having us be able to share our ideas with your listeners. So my background is I graduated college at University of Central Florida in Orlando with a bachelor's in communications. And then I got a master's in strategic intelligence from the Joint Military Intelligence College at the DIA in Washington, D.C. I'm a retired U.S. Navy intelligence officer. I started out as a combat photographer back when I was 17 years old. Does that answer your question?
It does. Now, and that's a great background. Now, Jeff, we'll move on to you. How about you, sir? Tell us a little bit about your education, your professional background, please.
Well, I'm a graduate of Ithaca College in New York, communications, video, film, production. Met Guy, actually, at the Office of Naval Intelligence 18 or 19 years ago. He was a reservist, and I was a civilian working at Naval Intelligence. And over our time, or overlap time there, we created a couple of videos that were related to the intelligence community. And back then, he was back 2000, 2001, he had just started or had already been working on the Hawaii Clipper project. So I've known about the project, Guy's project, since 2000, 2001, but didn't actually start kind of helping him out or getting more involved until about 7 or 8 years ago or so. So the rest is history, as you know.
All right. And last but certainly not least, Jim, how about you, sir?
Yeah, this is Jim. You know, I have a bachelor in chemical engineering. I'm a registered professional engineer, which is an exam and a certification that allows me to be a professional witness. I have experience as an amateur radio operator since 1976. I got my first license when I was in sixth grade. And I'm certified for celestial navigation by the American Sailing Association with a score high enough that if I wanted to, I could teach celestial navigation. I'm also a search and rescue trained, and I was attached to a sheriff's department in California. And I have a search dog who my wife and I have trained and have been involved in search and rescue and experience doing those things.
All right. So we have a great background for all three of you. Now, one more thing before we sort of dive in here, and Jeff, we'll start with you. Do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart? That's always a fun question to begin the show.
You know, I can't remember back that far. I think if you're under the age of 80 years old, you just know her. You come across the name in class, in history class, social studies class, throughout, you know, your formal education. So, you know, it just goes back as far as I can remember.
All right. Now, Guy, how about you, sir?
Yeah, actually, I can remember. It was 1977. I was 11 years old, and I was watching Leonard Nimoy in Search Of when he did the episode with Amelia Earhart. And I can still hear the theme music playing. And I remember hearing the story, and that was probably the first time I ever really, really thought about it. And then, of course, I was always intrigued with it. I've always been intrigued with aviation. And hearing about the story and that it was still an unsolved mystery, and that basically permeated my mind that to when I was researching my thesis, I was trying to figure out a story, and the story I settled on was the actual hunt for Amelia Earhart from the Navy's perspective. What did they do? What did they didn't do? What did they do right? What did they do wrong as my thesis? And that's when I stumbled upon the story of the Hawaii Clipper, which I can tell you later. But that's my first recollection of Amelia.
I got to tell you, if I had a penny for every time I heard In Search Of was the inspiration, we could probably fund everybody's search at this point.
Bingo.
So, yeah, for real. Okay, now, as I just said a few moments ago, this is one hell of a story. And it links two of aviation's greatest stories together in a way that's really quite spectacular. So, Guy, to kick things off tonight, I'm going to ask you to give us the plot of this story so we can get into the Lost Clipper and Amelia Earhart. Can you do that for us?
Okay, so I start with, there I was. No, so, wow. So I guess that just dovetails into how I just finished a little while ago. So there I was at the Defense Intelligence Agency in their library that they have there on the second floor at JMIC. And I'm just doing my research, and I come across a story with a gentleman by the name of Joe Gervais, who actually was in the In Search Of episode. And I'm reading the story of how he was he was a colonel in the Air Force at the time, and he was stationed in Japan, and he had heard that there was a crashed Electra that might be hers in a swamp in Micronesia, in Truk Lagoon. So he was able to finagle himself into getting a transport there, because it was a closed area because of the atomic testing they were doing at Bikini Atoll at that time. And he was able to go to Truk Lagoon, and then he hired himself a guide, and this guide took him over to another island where they went to this swamp where this airplane was. And it wasn't an Electra, it was a Betty bomber. So he was disappointed. And he had this guide, you know, show him around the island a little bit more. And this guide said, well, what about the 15 Americans? And he goes, what 15 Americans? He goes, well, the 15 Americans that are buried underneath the slab of concrete. And he goes, well, show me. So they walk there, and lo and behold, there's that slab of concrete. And he tells him a story that says, I didn't kill them. I just was part of the construction team that buried them here. They were all dead when we got here. And he told him the story. I found that story in the archive, and I immediately knew, you know, everyone's really heard about Amelia Earhart, and there's a bunch of theories and stories out there of what happened to her and why she was and where she was. But I had never heard the story before, and I decided at that moment this was going to be a story I was going to continue with, and I've been doing that ever since.
Now, Jeff, when you first hear this story, what in the world goes through your mind?
I mean, it's intrigued me since day one. I mean, a guy and I, Naval Intelligence, would spend many a night editing, and part of the editing process is waiting or doing your research. And, you know, he would just intrigue me with stories, and still to this day, just carrying on conversations, just hanging out, doing what we do. I mean, guys that, you know, starts telling a story that over the last almost 20 years for me, I'd never heard before. So there are just so many, there's just an overall plot, but there's just so many subplots that just make it made for television, made for, you know, documentaries, made for movies, you know, that sort of thing. And I think if the story gets out there, I think just so many people will not only, just a new generation will not only learn more about Amelia Earhart, but also the Hawaii Clipper. And that's why we're here.
Jim, from a technical aspect, celestial navigation, just everything like that, what do you think about this story when you first hear it? Is it possible to you? Or do you have doubts? Or is there any kind of skepticism whatsoever here?
Well, my first thought was, I didn't have theories. A guy came to me and said, hey, this is what I think's going on, and started talking to me about it. And I thought, well, is there a way I could add some value? And my view was, I just want to follow the data. And for me, it's about suspending any kind of bias. So I really don't want a theory. I just want to go look at it and see what's the data, what's the evidence, and then paint a picture like pieces of a puzzle and look at it and try to see what it's telling me. Because I always feel like confirmation bias will send me in the wrong direction. And I like to use, you know, data, numbers, and evidence to try to figure things out.
Yeah. Now, before we get into the AE portion of the story, because it's obviously amazing, Guy, educate our audience on the importance of the Clipper, because this is a story. It might not be as well known as Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan's World Flight, but it's something that's very crucial. It's a huge part of aviation history. Can you tell everybody that's listening about the Clipper?
Sure, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. You know, Pan Am is an airline that I would think that probably half your listeners maybe have never even heard of, or if they have, they've just seen it recently on a television show, but they don't really remember it. I mean, the very first flight of my life was on a Pan Am 747 coming from Germany to New York. So, and I still have my Pan Am wings. So that's always been an airline that's been dear to my heart. But it's a story that, you know, when you're looking for a, you know, an ideas of a mystery, something to solve, I always thought it was solvable. We just weren't looking in the right place. It's kind of like how I felt about Amelia Earhart. And so I started digging into it, and I started getting to learn about the 15 people that were on this plane, you know, the 9 crew and 6 passengers. And I started just digging as an intelligence officer would into the story. What is that data? And what Jim just said is spot on. You try to have no bias on anything. You just want to go where the data takes you. You can have theories and ideas, but you really want to back it up with data or facts, or at least something in there that leads to that. But it really changed once I started actually talking to the family members that still remember their fathers who were pilots on this plane. And when I got to speak with the Sauceda sisters, telling me about their father, Jose Sauceda, who was the third officer, the third pilot on this aircraft. And then I got to speak to some folks who were related to Mark Walker, who was the second in command of that aircraft. And I even spoke to the grandson of Edward Wyman, who was a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy at the time, and also a passenger, and then a couple other folks on there. When they gave me their stories, and they gave me the personal pictures that they had that had never been seen before, I started to have this emotional connection with these people as well. These are real people. And one thing that they all wanted is they wanted to be reunited with their fathers, with their family members, because they knew they were out there lost. Kind of like how some people feel about if your father was lost in Vietnam or in Korea, you'd want to bring them back. You know, you never close the story until you actually know what happened to them, when it happened, where it happened, and if you can, why it happened. So those are the stories that I just wanted to solve for these family members. So it became more of a personal mission to help them more than just solve a mystery.
Now, I did want to ask you guys something that is sort of just an organic question as you're talking. I don't want to say it's a done deal or anything like that, but the official United States government explanation for Earhart and Noonan and the World Flight is that they simply were downed near Howland Island and the plane rests 18,000 feet below the surface of the ocean as we speak. I want to ask you, before you guys got into this, and we'll start here with Jeff, before you got into this, did you have any preconceived notions? Did you sort of buy that original story? Were you sort of swayed with this new theory and the evidence that's kind of led you in the direction you guys have gone? Can you tell us a little bit about that? And Jeff, we'll start with you on that.
Well, I have to be honest here, and that is, I'm not a historian. Guy and Jim, of course, are historians in their background. So I don't really come. I never came to the project with any kind of preconceived notions or ideas because I don't have that background. And again, I defer all historical questions to Guy. So my mind is open. It just again intrigues me. More and more I learn about the project, and I'm starting to get interested in history.
Fair enough. Okay, Jim, what about you on that? I mean, this is, you know, having the background of celestial navigation, you're sort of in the mindset of Fred Noonan here. Did you have any preconceived notions about maybe what had happened to them? Did you accept that perhaps Noonan might have made a navigational error that caused him to be north of Howland, south of Highland, depending on who you talk to? When it comes to what happened to them, or were you sort of open to this once Guy told you about it?
Well, my view, you know, when I first heard about Amelia Earhart was in the 1970s, and I did see that In Search Of episode. And for me, you know, she and Fred were an inspiration for adventure and exploration. And that's something that actually has definitely had an influence on my life. You know, I've spent a lot of time running expeditions and mountaineering and sailing, and I'm also a private pilot. So when I saw this, and I always thought, even from a child, not so much that it was what the government had said, but just from what I had seen reported to me, that this was somebody who was on a great adventure, trying to do something nobody has ever done. That appealed to me. That appealed to me because, you know, we live these really short lives on this planet, and it's a chance to do something new and different and to push a new boundary. And I love that. And I think that's affected me my whole life. My assumption was that she was just got lost, but it could have been weather. It could have been the navigation. It could have been anything. But then when I looked at the detail recently, from my discussions with Guy, and I kind of warmed up on the Amelia Earhart data. I'm not an expert at it. I just started looking at the data. I got really frustrated in what I saw being reported because it didn't make sense to me.
Guy, I mean, this all started with you. Let me get your answer on that. I mean, what did you think? Did you have preconceived notions? Did you sort of buy that? Did you say, oh, something's not right here? What made you start even looking at this possibility?
Well, honestly, I never really considered Amelia Earhart. I mean, I was always a fan of hers. I thought she was amazing. And one of the goals in my life, I would like, is to eventually get her nominated for a medal, from a Congressional Service Medal. I think she deserves one. I thought she deserved one because of what I knew of what she did before, and really just breaking new boundaries, especially for women in aviation. But then the funny thing happened. I'm interviewing the family members of the Hawaii Clipper, the pilots, especially Jose Sauceda. And the daughters tell me their father died on a secret mission rescuing Amelia Earhart. And I'm like, what? I never read that anyplace. And here's this very elderly woman, but very sharp as a bell. In fact, I wanted to double check this, so I'm going to jump ahead in that story for a few minutes and say that dear friends of the Hawaii Clipper Project is none other than Steve Murphy and Javier Pena. These are the two guys that the television show on Netflix, Narcos, is all about. It started with them. These are the two DEA agents who found, tracked down, and took down Pablo Escobar with the aid of the Colombian police. They found Pablo Escobar. Amazing, amazing feat that they did. So I figured if these guys can do that, they're experts at interviewing people. So would they interview some of these witnesses, eyewitnesses, I call them, because their fathers and their grandparents told them these stories. So that's exactly what happened. They interviewed them and they said, you know what? We're experts in knowing who's telling us the truth and who's not. And these people are telling us the truth that they believe that their fathers were on a secret mission for the government carrying ransom to bring back Amelia Earhart. And I had never heard that. It just floored me. So that's one of the reasons I reached out to Jim, because Jim, out of all people, and I think you should go back to him on this question, is that he really drilled down the data in a way that I don't think most people have, because he's also a pilot. So he's a pilot, a celestial navigator. He's a researcher. He's a chemical engineer. He can also track down people who are crashed, you know, the aviation with tracking dogs. So when you put all that stuff together into this pot, he pulls out this information that in a way I've never seen or heard of before, that convinced me that these people on the Hawaii Clipper died in their mind on a mission to rescue and recover Amelia Earhart. And all along, I think it could have been a double cross, that the captors who put the bait on never actually had her, but they wanted the plane. And that's what brought us full circle. So if you'd like, I'd like to have Jim actually dig a little deeper, because I know your audience would love to hear more about the theories and ideas that we have that we bring to the table that are fresh and new about Amelia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great idea. And Jim, talk about drilling down the data like you did. What does that drilling tell us?
You know, I offer this in that it helps, hopefully, people who are deep into her story and trying to finally solve the details of that mystery. But I told you I was frustrated when I looked at the information. And I think that was because I just assumed these were people who became lost. And then I started looking at what had been reported. And when I looked at the details of every little piece, but then I backed up and look at them within context, they did not make sense in context. And I'll be more specific, but when I look at those two folks in that airplane, what I did is I sat back and I envisioned myself in the pilot seat flying the plane, because I am a pilot, I'm a private pilot. And then I imagined Fred Noonan, who's sitting in the back, you know, passing notes with a fishing pole up to the pilot. And what's it like in there with the hum of the engines when you're flying or you're on an expedition, whether I'm on a boat in difficult weather and you've got a motor running, you become incredibly attuned to the engines, because any sputter or miss on a single fire of a cylinder is a sign that you may be going down in a very remote area with very difficult chance of survival. And so I know they're in touch with that. And I know Fred's in touch with the stars, constantly shooting those and calculating those. And the documents they use for the reference documents for determining their position is actually the same documents we use for small sailing boats. We just have to use a different correction factor for our height above the water. And so, you know, the celestial nav, he's constantly checking that. And they're, I'm sure, looking at the weather. And you're very in tune with your environment. And I think it's in a way that people who don't get out into an area where they're out there on their own a bit and in the dark and you know, you're busy with city lights and our busy daily lives, we don't experience how in touch you get with all that. And so I was trying to figure out why these people behave the way they did. And after I got frustrated, I realized I needed to stop assuming they just got lost and just look at the data and try to paint a picture and see what it told me. And one of the things I would say is, keep in mind, to have context on this, they left California, they went to Miami, and they went all around the planet, at the thickest part of the planet, right? So they're going around close to the equator, and they have spent many, many days flying and navigating. And I'll tell you, when you're doing this, and you're doing it day after day after day, you get really good at it. It's what they did for a very long time until they came to this last leg of their journey. So by the time they got here, I mean, Fred Noonan was world-class already. I think he was the top choice for her. And now they're at Leh and they're heading off on these last legs of the journey. And I looked at their, I got my chart plotter out and I started charting any positional information I could find. And so she was reporting very nicely, properly out of Leh. And she was on course as best I could tell. And I could see where they were heading toward an island they were going to use as a fix. So they had a good fix. And they were reporting their altitude, they were reporting their airspeed, the weather, and their position in lat long, longitude, latitude, longitude. And that all made sense, and that's what you would do. And then at 785 miles out of Leh, everything changes. And the way they communicate changes, and it never comes back to what it was all the way around the world until this point. And at that point, she's talking to the radio operator in Leh, giving all that great information on a regular basis. And I'm plotting it on here, thinking about the weather and what it's like and her, you know, her altitude and what she's saying. And then she says she's going to switch to her other frequency. Now she's got a crystal transmitter radio with two frequencies. So she's going to flip the switch and go to the second frequency. And these are the HF bands, the high frequency bands. And her two bands are close to the 80 meter and 40 meter bands of amateur radio. And so she's going to flip this switch, and the guy in the radio operator in Leh is begging her not to, because he's getting such a good signal. There's no reason to. And she switches anyway. And from that moment on, we never hear from her again until she reports in something like 200 miles. She says she's like 200 miles out of Howland. And so for most of the journey, she's completely silent. She chose to not communicate. If she switched to the next frequency and it was static and it wasn't, you know, carrying the distance, it was a switch. Just turn that switch back to the left and should have been back talking to Leh, full signal strength, completely readable. And she chose to stop communicating at that point.
So this is, in your opinion, not a lack of two-way communication. This was not something that went wrong. This was an intentional switch by Earhart.
Absolutely. And, you know, she even said she was going to switch frequencies. The radio operator said, don't. And now if she switches and then stopped and it didn't work and they couldn't talk, why wouldn't she just switch it back? And he kept trying to contact her and she never came back. It was an excuse to me of why would she stop communicating and entering this toward the center? She's about a third of the way to Howland. Why would she stop communicating then? That's the most critical point.
So does this sort of become, for lack of a better term to explain this, like a dark side of the moon type deal, where they get to a certain point and they switch off communication? The official story or the official idea is that they're going to go to Howland, but at a certain point, she's going to switch off her communication. They're going to do the actual secret intended mission, which is what you guys are kind of discussing, which we'll get into in just a little bit. Is that sort of what happens here, do you think?
I wasn't there yet. I just knew that she intentionally stopped communicating with this guy, which made no sense, and it just frustrated me. I think that was a piece of the puzzle. And again, I wanted to see a whole picture of context. So the next thing I did was looked at all of her communications that when they came back. And when she came back, her communication style and information she provided was completely different from what she had done, you know, prior to that moment she went dark. And what I mean by that is, it's really frustrating trying to find out where she is. She doesn't report her position. She doesn't give the normal information you would give. And keeping in mind, she has multiple hours of extra fuel if she missed the island. There's plenty of time to navigate and shoot more sun lines. It's a clear day. The Itasca's belching smoke, and the Itasca's reporting good weather. You can see, 30 plus miles at 1,000 feet up, and you have really good view. People say, oh, she missed it in the sun. Well, she could see it from many angles over multiple hours as they navigate to this thing with Fred Noonan. Did he really? Is it? And why did they never give? Why were they so cagey about how they're approaching the island? And, I could see where the Navy, some of the radio operators, like on the Itasca, were really frustrated with them not giving the standard information.
Yeah, when Leo Bellarts was on our very own show, we did an Icon episode with him, and he spoke specifically about how frustrated not only him, but everybody on the Itasca was that she was not responding to any kind of communication that they were throwing out. So when you talk about that, that sort of kind of falls in line with what Leo Bellarts was actually saying. So I'm wondering now if Leo Bellarts and the people on the Itasca knew sort of the real story, or if they were sort of just stationed off the coast of Howland and told to do what they normally do, and sort of weren't part of the inner circle of what was really going on.
I don't think they knew. I don't think they were, if she had another mission, I don't think they were read in based on the behaviors I picked up later. And if I could read a piece of the Navy report to you, just how frustrated these guys were about what she wasn't reporting.
Sure.
It says, we have had no positions, speeds, or courses from Earhart's plane, except so-called line of position at 0843, which had no reference point, period. She gave us none of her bearings, period. Okay, Fred Noonan's on that plane. Okay, if that's the case, it was on purpose. Cut me a break. And in fact, all of her communications at that point, once she resurfaces this 200 miles out from Howland, there was a game I used to play as a kid in the swimming pool with friends. We called it Marco Polo. I don't know if you heard of it.
Oh, yeah.
You say Marco, somebody says Polo, and you try to figure out where they are. And I'm like, why has she become like playing Marco Polo with these guys? She's like, oh. And she gives a line of the reason this thing has a quote so-called line of position, and I'm familiar with LOPs and lines of position. I'm sure you've talked about it on your show. You know, a line of position is 100% useless without a reference point. It's an infinite number of lines at that angle on the planet. You need another point of data to say something about it. And so why would they report an LOP from a celestial navigator who's never given an LOP before? You always give a lat long. And then some people say, this kind of drives me a little crazy when I hear these comments that, well, they were lost, so they didn't know their latitude, longitude. That makes no sense, because when you're navigating, you always have a most probable position, and it's never exactly right. You're hopefully, if you're really good, within a 3 to 5 miles, if you're really good. And so you always have a lat long where you think you are, or you most probable are. So that there's no excuse for not reporting that information.
Yeah, you make a good point. Now, I'm going to play the devil's advocate, because I do that with every show, with every theory. That's just what I do, just for the sake of, because if I don't do it, I'm going to hear it from our listeners via email and phone call. So what I do want to ask you is about the Itasca. Since we're on the Itasca, we're sort of at that point in the flight. Here's what we know, or at least with what historical documentation states. We have the Itasca logs, and we're looking, when we do Vanished Amelia Earhart, we're doing it sort of like a jury trial case. So if this is a modern day murder, the Itasca logs are like the final text messages, right? So this is kind of one of those scenarios where we have these written logs from Leo Bellarts and some of the other folks that were on the Itasca. You've got AE specifically calling into the microphone stating, we must be on you but cannot see you. We're 200 miles out, 100 miles out. They're trying to find her. Bellarts states emphatically so that he expected to see them on the horizon. He stepped outside the radio booth and expected to hear or see them on the horizon, yet they got nothing. So my question is, what gives there when it comes to where they were at? Guy, did they ever get close to Howland? Was that the intention? Was this sort of a fake out? Educate us all here on kind of your position and the position of your team on this. What's the theory?
Sure. Thank you very much. No, and that's an excellent question. And what I will say is, and Jim developed a great answer to that. And it's basically that it's not the proximity of the aircraft, it's the angle of the antenna and what it was doing. Jim, fill them in.
Yeah, so I looked at this issue because it looked like signal strength was what people were focusing on. And, I was, as a I got into amateur radio when I was quite young, and I would stay up until 3 or 4 a.m. and spend hours and hours and hours on the radio. And I was lucky enough to have a father who was an amateur radio operator. He was actually a naval radio operator at Barbers Point in Hawaii in 1957 to 59. And he taught me amateur radio, and he had a Radio Shack and every kind of antenna you could imagine. So I had access to great equipment. And I used to spend the night bouncing signals around the planet, talking to people all around, you know, all around the world. I remember bouncing a signal off the Aurora Borealis to Bhutan to talk to someone. And so I really got a good feel for skip and how signal strength works. And I think few people have a sense of this. And the reason is the skip is controlled by the sunspot cycle. I don't know if you guys have gotten into that in any of your other discussions, but there was a sunspot cycle maximum in April 1937. So 1937 and 1938 were really great years for skipping signals and getting large signal strength anywhere around the planet, wherever the skip comes down from the ionosphere. And the ionosphere is charged from all this extra radiation particles coming from the sun. And what's interesting is in the late 1970s, it was called the sun cycle 21, which was the one I was in, and sun cycle 17 was the one that Amelia Earhart was in. They both have similar intensities. And I think few people remember what it's like because we haven't had one that intense since 1990. So we have 30 years of people with no experience of what it's like to talk over these high frequency signals that you can bounce around the planet. Let me give you a sense. So I remember talking to a guy in Germany. I was based in Pennsylvania, where I grew up, in Western Pennsylvania. And I couldn't hardly talk to this guy, but he was talking to somebody in California very clearly. And I could hear him talking to that person. I wanted to work this guy, meaning I wanted to contact him. And so what I did is I took our beam, and we had a six element Yagi, and I spun the beam around from east to west. And his signal strength came in booming. So I'm listening and talking to him from around the planet instead of direct to Europe. And that's because when the skip comes in strong from these sunspot cycles being strong, the skip angles get real wide, and you're just trying to find a spot where you're getting the strong skip. And so you have to be really careful about signal strength. The other thing that I'm hoping people have looked at is, if you look at an airplane's antenna, these folks are carrying a trailing antenna, or they might have a similar oriented wire going from the cockpit back to the tail. That's called a long wire if it's fed on one end, and it radiates not hardly at all out of the tip. It radiates sideways. And so the least radiation goes toward the front of the plane and the back of the plane, and I mean by a large amount. So you get an incredible amount of gain from the antenna sideways. And if you turn that airplane or you circle, then you're going to have an immediate boost, a huge boost in signal strength. I don't mean a small amount. I mean, it's going to be a huge difference. If you took a North American football and you took the 2 points of the football, but you ran somehow a wire straight through the center of the football from point to point, that football shape would represent the strength of the radiation coming off of there of your signal strength. In general terms, to give you a sense of where the strength is.
Gotcha. Okay, so there are going to be a lot of people Googling skip after this episode. I can promise you that. Okay. Right. Yeah. And we have talked about that a little bit in Vanished Amelia Earhart with some of the folks that are working the crash site at Buca and some of the other folks. So, I mean, skip is not something that should be unfamiliar to our listeners, but that's a fantastic explanation of how skip works. So I want to shift gears a little bit. I'm going to ask you all this next question, and Jeff, I'll start with you. When you're starting with the story of the Clipper and then you discover that that story ties into the Earhart investigation, does your intrigue meter just go straight up when you hear that?
Absolutely. We were on Expedition 4 in January of last year, 2018, and we were doing our research. And as we researched more Guy and our contact, Bill Stinnett in Micronesia, went down to the local the school. They did all sorts of research, and basically by the end of that trip, our focus did not magnify as we had expected it to just on the Hawaii Clipper, but we had to pull back and investigate, well, what caused the whole incident with the Hawaii Clipper? And when we realized that Amelia Earhart was involved in the storytelling, I mean, I just recall sitting around the dinner table one night after a long day of research and digging and hunting, that, you know, all our minds were blown, that was the direction that we had to go to really tell the story of the Hawaii Clipper.
Jim, what about you?
For me, I was trying to figure out why, you know, how would this really be connected to Amelia? And the transition from what we just discussed about her to the Hawaii Clipper, a piece of the story that I think is important and finished painting a picture for me of what may have happened. And this is just the best I could come up with what I saw in the data, is you need to understand the search and rescue, which is something I have experienced in. And the search and rescue endeavor was very strange indeed. And I've heard it reported on one of your other podcasts that the Itasca searched northeast, but it actually took off northwest. I plotted on my chart plotter from their logbooks, their direction, from exactly how they went. And what's interesting is, here's where they didn't do follow what I would consider normal search and rescue. Technically, once she's gone, the incident commander would be the captain of the Itasca. That person has the most information. That person will have more information than you or I or any researcher will ever have. I find it hard to believe the radio operators had no clue what direction her signal strength came from. If she was reporting clouds and there weren't clouds except to the north, I've heard some things like that. Whoever that was, that incident commander had the most information, and he took off in the northwest direction. And if you draw a line up, his first three positions that he reported were pointing just to the east of the Marshall Islands, the eastern edges of the Marshall Islands, a little bit further out. And then he did, from there, do a zigzag pattern to the right to go northeast. But his initial instinct was to go northwest. But the shocking part for me was when the Navy turned him around and stopped the search. Now, when somebody's missing, your chances of finding them alive are pretty high in the first 24 hours, maybe 80%. At the end of 3 days, it's very rare to find somebody that survived. And so that first 24 hours is important. And yet the Navy turned around the Itasca and they lost the whole 24 hours. And the way they turned them around is they changed the incident commander from the captain of the boat. They put somebody in Hawaii in charge. And then they sent out a PBY float plane to meet, to fly down to Howland Island to help with the search, a single plane. And they told the Itasca to turn around to refuel that plane. That just sounds suspicious. Why would you do that? And the plane flew, it took them like 12 or so hours. They flew 80% of the way there. It's something like 1600 miles before they turned around. And they said, oh, they hit a weather patch. So they turned back around to Hawaii. So they flew twice that distance all the way back to Hawaii and had no fuel. But yet they turned the Itasca around and said, no, go meet them at Howland. You're going to need to refuel them. And that stopped the search. And now it was dark. And so since it was dark, the Itasca waited till the light of the next day. So they lost a whole 24 hours. And I was like, why would somebody in Hawaii turn around the Itasca? I mean, this is something that you can't prove. But as far as the reasoning I could come up with is, if there was something where they knew where she was, and whatever the circumstances were around it, if she was taken prisoner by the Japanese or whatever, and we had broken their codes and somebody knew it in Hawaii and they handed it to this high-level person to say, hey, turn the Itasca around because they're heading toward the mandates and that would start a war if a military vessel entered into Japanese waters, and that's right where they're headed. That is right where they're headed, and they turn them around. The other weird thing, why is it when they sent more search boats and planes, they never searched to the northwest again? They searched south, and everybody focuses south. It's like, oh, keep all the ships safe, stay out of there. Let's just not get any military aircraft and things near the danger zone where we could light off a war. And again, remember the context. You're looking at July 2. You know, 5 days later, what happened? Japan started war with China. Do you think all the Japanese listening posts weren't attuned with somebody flying on their right up, skimming their southern strongholds in the Pacific on the mandated islands that they felt they owned? You know they were monitoring everything she was doing. It'd be great training too, but they were, nobody else in the world knew, but they were 5 days away from starting war.
You think Earhart, Noonan knew?
You know, I don't. I don't think they would know war was going to start. There were so many things going on, tit for tats. I think that people kind of were on alert that Japan was building up to some big event. And I think that was probably true. It wouldn't shock me if somebody asked her to go look at the marshals and take a quick look and say, hey, do they have an installation there? What's there? I mean, they don't have satellites. And since she's a civilian plane, and, you know, Pan Am civilian flights could fly across the Pacific because they were civilian. Yeah, maybe. I mean, they could have gone up there to try to take some pictures, gotten in trouble or something where they ended up landing there. And now what are you going to do? You know, if you're sitting near that area, whether you're on an island or the water, how are you going to tell the Itasca to find you without saying, oh, hey, I'm up here. And how'd you get up there? Well, you know.
And I'd like to jump in, Chris, for a moment and just dovetail to that, because what our research was going with is that we're trying to answer the questions, why are these people doing what they're doing when it doesn't really seem to follow any kind of standard protocol? And that's what kind of led our research to going to Kodak and Bausch & Lomb up in New York. And we were discovering that there were actually newspaper articles printed that showed that she was visiting Rochester in New York, looking at the camera that was going to be installed in her flying laboratory. So when you're thinking about weight for your Electra and you're leaving what I, in my mind would be critical gear on the runway in Miami because you're worried about weight, you know, could this camera have been installed in Leh or even Australia before they got to Leh and then installed, and then they'd go code silent because they don't want to give these Japanese operators a fix on where they're flying, and they're going dark so it can do this photography of the Marshall Islands, and then they're going to swing, you know, 800, 900 miles from, you know, where they are in the Marshalls to head towards Howland. And they fly over Mille Atoll, which I personally think is where they crash landed. And then they get lost because they burnt up a whole bunch of gas on this northern venture. So, you know, that really started to pique our interest of why they were where they were and what they were doing.
Guy, what are the odds that during an investigation like this, you hit a potential jackpot this big?
I think the odds are very strong. And again, we're not so much looking for Amelia. We're not looking for her plane. We're more about looking why she was, where she was she working for FDR? Because we know for a fact in numerous places it's written that FDR was a great collector of intelligence and that he was using his celebrity, socialite connections, his relationships to do his investigations because he didn't so much trust what he was getting from both the Army and the Navy. So he's using, you know, Lindbergh in Germany, you know, he's flying with the Luftwaffe, he's photographing their, you know, their airfields. You know, why not use Amelia Earhart to do the same thing over the Pacific, where she's going? I mean, when there are so many things, you know, that I've heard and I've seen that show that in my mind, she was working for the United States, and why I go back and think that she's worthy of a medal because she died in the service of her country.
So with that being said, Guy, I'm going to ask you this point blank because it's been widely debated on Chasing Earhart, on Vanished Amelia Earhart. It's been widely debated in the Earhart mystery. Was Amelia Earhart a spy?
I think she was. I really do. I mean, and to me, what's going to bring that to Expedition 5, which is why we're here and what we're trying to do, is the family members of the Hawaii Clipper perished, believing they were carrying ransom to bring back Amelia Earhart. And I think what actually the truth was is they weren't never going to get Amelia. They were just going to get this plane stolen from them, which Jim has also done some research on using his chemical engineering background. And we believe we have some solid proof. Well, I can't say proof, but we have some solid understandings on what most likely occurred to the plane and why it occurred. But they died believing they were going to be rescuing America's hero, right? So why was she there? Why would she need a camera in an airplane? Why would she disappear? Why would she go code silent? Why would the Navy change the trajectory of the Itasca and to go in the other direction? And I believe it was because we could have revealed to the Japanese who were monitoring her flight, and it could have tipped them off that we had broken their codes. We had broken their transmissions. And you did not want to do that, you know, because then, you know, that would throw a whole lot of effort and time, you know, out the window when we really need to know what they were doing and how they were doing it. So I think they had to let her go and not reveal that we've broken their code.
You know, I wanted to add one other thing to that, Chris. You know, one other interesting piece of the puzzle is when they couldn't find her, then they contacted Japan and they asked Japan to help search for Amelia Earhart. Why did they contact Japan? And why did they wait to contact Japan, not get them involved right away, after they avoided going toward Japanese waters? They pulled everybody back from that way. And I thought, why would you do that? And then I realized that if they had broken the codes and did not want to reveal that, a way to save face or to get Japan to reveal they had her would be to say, would you join the search? And they could have, it gave the Japanese a chance to be the heroes and say, hey, we did find her. And then it was a way to find out without breaking the code. So I think that was the only reason I could see for asking Japan to join when we're searching away from Japan. And then all of a sudden we ask them to try to find her.
Guy, what makes the Clipper at this point the best route to go here when it comes to retrieving her potentially, or the plane?
Retrieving Amelia and the plane?
One or the other, depending on what you guys actually find out.
We're not so much looking to retrieve either of those. We're looking to retrieve her reputation. Her reputation is not at stake. She is a hero. What I'm looking to do more is that if we find the DNA, if we find the family members buried in Truck Lagoon after this plane allegedly vanished in the very similar situation in the same area that Amelia vanished, then I think that we come closer to the overall picture that Jim has been talking about, that another couple puzzle pieces that we didn't know were there. That if we find them, we find these 15 Americans that vanished, that to me were the first victims of World War II. They died at the hands of Japanese aviators who might have been criminals as well as the earlier, and not the Yakuza, but the predecessor to that was the Black Ocean Society, the Black Dragons. You know, there are criminal elements within the Japanese military, especially within the Japanese Navy. So if they killed this, if they killed these 15 Americans and then flew the plane to Japan to do reverse engineer it, to look into it, obviously take the $3 million in gold banknotes if they were indeed on board there, then we solve that smoking gun. Then we find these people that everyone believes, for the most part, vanished out to sea. Then I think that gives us credence to, okay, yeah, maybe they were on a mission to recover Amelia and they were going to meet in the middle of the ocean to do the grand exchange. And all that happened was they lost her aircraft. It was stolen from them. Then that lets us know that maybe she was working for the United States and maybe it cost her life.
Jim, in the research you guys have done for this, who knew about this? How top secret was the Clipper rescue mission?
I'll tell you, I never heard of it myself till Guy mentioned it. And my initial thought was, with, you know, my experience in search and rescue, is can I get closure for these families? And, you know, I've been on many searches where we meet the families and, you know, they're distraught and they want some resolution. And, you know, hopefully we find people alive, but sometimes we don't. Regardless, we're doing a service for these folks. And my thought was, well, if these folks are on this location, I want to find them and bring them home. And it's just another part of me that wants to do that for search and rescue. But what was kind of shocking to me is when I plotted on the chart plotter, the flight of the Hawaii Clipper, Truck Lagoon is nowhere near it. In fact, they needed to refuel somewhere to get there. So if these bodies are found where Guy thinks they are, that you have to kind of take some of this this story seriously and look closer at the Amelia Earhart connection. But I think it's time to bring these folks home. If they're there, I'm gonna get them. I'm gonna find them. If those bodies are there, and that's where the search dogs are gonna come in, which was Guy and us sitting around, Guy, Jeff, and I sitting around talking about how do we find these folks. I was thinking, wow, we need a body detector, and I thought, oh, dogs. That's what they are, and that's where that started.
One of the coolest lines, I think, in the recently dropped sizzle, which of course we'll have a link to in the show notes tonight, is that you mentioned the Clipper crew. They were carrying $3 million in gold banknotes as a trade. So, Jeff, can you tell our audience what that would be equivalent to in today's currency?
Today's currency is about $54 to $56 million.
Incredible.
That's a lot.
Now, it is. Now, you mentioned, of course, the folks from Narcos earlier in the show. How did they get involved in this story, Guy?
Well, it's kind of funny. Steve Murphy was a neighbor of mine and Jeff as well. So it was literally in his backyard at a barbecue, watching the debut of Narcos season 2. And we became friends after that. And then we met Javier, and they invited us to videotape them in one of their earlier speaking events they were doing here in Leesburg, Virginia. And we just became close friends and started working with them, producing some videos for them, you know, to help them out. And now they're on worldwide speakers. And when you do that and they fall in love with your story, then they said, hey, we want to help you because you've helped us. And they've done that. And Javier is from San Antonio, Texas, and that's where the Sauceda sisters live. So he was able, with myself, we went to their home and we spoke to them a couple times and filmed them. And he interviewed them and showed them pictures and asked them all kinds of questions. And I really got to see a master at work at how you really interview an eyewitness. And it's completely different than how I would as a journalist, you know, how I did in the news industry. And the analysis that came after that really just made it even that much more intriguing and real for all of us. But that's how we got the relationship.
The next question, as you've been talking about all this, all of you, I've been sort of thinking about this organically, and it's really a question for all of you. So I'm going to collect all the answers for this particular question. It's a deep, dare I say, possibly potentially painful one to answer, just because of the legacy and just because of kind of who's involved and what's involved here. In the sizzle, if I remember correctly, Javier makes a statement, and I think it's very telling. He says something along the lines of, we're going to have to unravel all the secrets that exist. When I've spoken to different folks investigating different theories, I always tell them that if they're going to go down a specific road, they may not like what they find. Are you sure? Are you really sure that you want to tell this story? So that's really what I sort of ask everyone, because it could really rewrite the history books and potentially hurt reputations that a lot of people feel are beloved. So I want to ask for the panel's thoughts on this. And Guy, we'll start with you on that.
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, we're all seekers of truth. We want to know what the truth is, what really happened, because that's how you get closure. And I've always known, going way back from my training and analysis, is that you don't want to, I guess, set up, I'll only be happy with a certain outcome. Any outcome, as long as it's real, is what you want. And if I spend all my time and we spend all our effort and we go there and there's no bodies there, well, then that's closure. I mean, because we did everything we had. I've spent 20 years and over $100,000 of my own money trying to figure this out. And if they're not there and we're satisfied that we did a thorough search, then that's a good answer to me. You know, and the same thing with Amelia. Was she a spy? Was she not? I want to know these things, you know, because I think it's important. I think that people be recognized for the what they did and what they experienced, and especially with her and the passengers and crew of the Hawaii Clipper. I think truth is the best compliment that any of them would ever want.
Jeff, what are your thoughts on that?
I've been working with Guy again for the last 7 years or so, and mainly working on social media and the Facebook aspects, Twitter, and of course the website. And I see quite a number of responses to posts that we do, specifically from some family members that are either still alive or are relatives, have obviously, you know, 80 years have gone by just about, and they want to know what happened to my father, what happened to my, you know, grandfather. So I think it's almost become personal for me, where you see just the outpouring of love for somebody that you might not have, a parent that you never really got to know, in the case of the Sauceda sisters. You know, they were super young when their father was taken from them. So it's more personal for me, just again, keeping my thumb on the pulse of the public and the families, you know, outpouring of hope of recovery of the 15 bodies.
Jim, Penny, for your thoughts on that.
Just my opinion, I don't see how it would hurt someone's reputation. I see it as enhancing their reputations in service to their country. I think that goes for the people on the Hawaii Clipper, and I understand the crew, those folks, a lot of them were reservists. I think that goes for Amelia and Fred. If that becomes true, that they were helping gather information, I think it would be naive to think that somebody like, we kind of get a glimpse into these heroes' lives at times, like Francis Gary Powers, right, when he shot down over Russia. And he was getting important information, and U-2 spy planes were used to gather information over Cuba that prevented a global nuclear conflagration. And these people do these things at risk in without any fanfare or recognition because of the nature of what they're doing, but the goodness does come out of that. And I really don't see how you could, you know, say that sullies somebody's reputation to give that way and then end up giving the ultimate sacrifice to their country. In fact, I think we owe them, all of these people, an obligation to recognize what they really did. And it's time. Too much time has gone by. And, you know, if there were going to be hurt reputations or feelings for some other reason, I think those need to be left in the past, and we need to recognize what these folks did for us.
Very well said. Now, Guy, if the history books were written the way they were supposed to be written, what was the goal with this mission for the Clipper? What was supposed to happen if they had been successful?
I believe what it would have been if it was, well, it was a double cross, I believe. So the aircraft is on a mission to carry the money to have a rendezvous with the Japanese, probably at sea, and do the prisoner exchange. And there's been various theories. There was one, there's, you know, maybe there was two guys in the back of the plane and they hijacked it, and then they flew it to a specific spot in the ocean where, you know, an oil slick was left during the refueling of it all. I guess in their minds, they would get Amelia and they would continue flying to the Philippines and say, hey, we recovered her, and this was this joint effort, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think that was ever going to happen. I think, you know, that personally, I think that Amelia was executed in Saipan, and that after they discovered that she did have an airplane or a camera on her airplane. And I think these people who wanted the Clipper didn't really care about the money. I think they just wanted the plane because they thought it was high technology, and they wanted to study the engines and whether they would be useful if there was any technology on those Pratt & Whitney engines to the Zero. So I think the whole goal was actually to steal the airplane and not really give Amelia to anyone and not really so much about the money, and take that plane to Truck Lagoon, and where they took the 15 Americans off, interrogated them, killed them with poison and buried them, and then flew the plane on to Japan where it was studied.
So as far as the crew of the Clipper is concerned, they're thinking it's a very cut and dry thing. They set out on this mission. They have $3 million in gold bonds to give them. They give them the money, they get Earhart, fly home, and that's that.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was so serious too, because the pilots, the night before the trip, they were all meeting in the home of the second pilot, and they were talking about what was going on and what they're, and they were very, 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 according to Mark Walker's sister, Mark Walker was the pilot, it was his home, that they were very uneasy, that they were very nervous, that this seemed to be something odd about this. In fact, and she noted other things, that on his, when he closed the window on the airplane, that he never waved, but on this time he was waving like crazy. And like, it was like, I might not see you for a long time. And in fact, he left her a note that she found after he disappeared, saying that if I don't come back from this trip, please take care of my new car. When his sister went to the Pan Am offices after the plane was declared missing, she looked at one of the supervisors who was working the weather desk, and she said, what happened? He says, oh, it looks like we might have lost them in a typhoon. And she looked right behind the guy, and the weather pattern was clear. Now, you have to think that Pan Am started the whole weather program just for its airline, and they were like one of the masters at forecasting weather, and it was clear. And the double check that I pulled the U.S. Air Force records that maintains records ever since 1886. And for that entire week, it was perfect flying weather in that region of the Pacific. So there was no typhoon. There was no weather that would cause a plane. And when he said this to her, he averted her look, and he looked down and just walked away because they both knew he was lying. So you have that. You also have the Cicadas, who he drove his family, his wife and three daughters, from Alameda all the way to San Antonio. And he dropped off his kids with his parents, saying, I might not be coming back for a while, and if I don't return in a year, please tell them that I died rescuing Amelia Earhart. He said those words to his children, and they still cling to that today. So those two families just there are telling me, you know, what was going on, what might have happened.
Do we know anything about what happened, may or may not have happened to Noonan? What did he suffer the same fate as Earhart on Saipan that you know of?
You know, again, I don't know that either. I believe from what I've read from other researchers that have told me In fact, I had dinner with Rick Spooner just last year, who showed me his what he alleges is the eye band that was covering her face, a face mask that was covering her just before she was shot and executed and thrown into a grave. He recovered that. He was a soldier. He was a Marine in 1944 in Saipan. And that was very real to him. And he was very, very clear in telling me how, you know, that she was allegedly given the choice to either die a coward with the mask over her face or to face her executioner with courage. And she chose courage. And they removed it and then shot her point blank in the chest while she was on her knees. And she went back into a grave and she was buried. And then 2 weeks later, allegedly, the local Saipanese are all talking about how the Japanese killed the American flying lady. You know, they all knew who she was because she was the only lady they ever saw wearing pants or had short hair like hers, dressed like a man. And the Japanese got nervous. So they went back and dug her up, but they missed the blindfold that was thrown in the grave with her. And the emollinator, they basically burned her to ashes so no one would ever find her. But they missed that head cover. And when Rick Spooner went back, you know, 50 years later, he went to that spot by the breadfruit tree and boom, guess what he found? He found that piece. So I don't know. No one knows, but we have ideas of what might have happened.
Guy, as you're talking about that, I want to ask a question that I think we need to really hammer home for the young people that are in the audience. I know this is sort of this is obviously not a pleasant ending for Earhart, but if this is indeed what happened, how powerful do you think it was that she chose courage and chose to actually have her eyes uncovered, that she actually stood in that face of absolute fear that would scare the crap out of anybody really at that point? How important do you think that was, and what does that tell you about Earhart's character in that final moment?
She's always shown to me courage, you know, just and doing the things that she did, a courageous person does, a weak person would not. So I would not be surprised by her choice. When you think about what Henry Morgenthau, who was the Secretary of Treasury at the time of FDR during this time, and he was having discussions with the White House and with Eleanor Roosevelt, and there's, you know, tapes, so there's, you know, transcriptions of conversations he was having. And from what they were saying, I think they had an idea what had happened to her. They said it would go very bad for her if this was true and that she disobeyed orders. You know, what are those orders that she disobeyed? What are they talking about? Those are the kind of secrets that we really want to reveal, and we want to find out more. What was going on and what happened and what did we know and when did we know it, as General Colin Powell once said. So I think it's important for your listeners, especially young ones, knowing that courage, no matter what happens, courage is key to your legacy of who you are, what you stood for.
My last question tonight before we wrap up is perhaps the most important one. Now, this is a two for one. So it's been 82 years now. This is our last theory piece for Chasing Earhart. Tell us why it's so important for not only the Earhart Noonan story to have an end, but for the Clipper story to have an end as well.
Chris, what I would say is I see this as bringing these folks home, telling us the real story, getting closer to the truth for everyone. But one thing that I think is exciting about it too is, you know, hasn't been a lot of real new physical evidence about the whole Earhart mystery for a long time, right? Real hard physical evidence. And these bodies, if we find them in the Truk Lagoon, that's hard physical evidence that something's up, because they shouldn't have been anywhere near that part of the ocean. And, you know, with all these other pieces of information, we put it together. It makes you really think about, hey, we have to actually take some of this stuff seriously and do more investigation, because it's hard physical evidence and there hasn't been anything tied to the whole Earhart mystery that's physical, that's really good hard stuff for, I think, a long time.
All right, Guy, what do you think?
You know, I mean, that's completely spot on, Jim. And, you know, we're average everyday people. We're folks just like you who've always had a dream of the story. And we put ourselves in a position to kind of take the lead and solve this story. And along the way, we've actually found little nuggets, like Jim has alluded to, that is new information. And there's still more information that we haven't even touched on here. If you had a 2-hour program, maybe we could get into some of that. But we've found new things that I don't think people have really put together from the kind of particular Rubik's Cube way of seeing things that we've seen, that we've put together. So we're literally inviting people to join us on this expedition virtually to help solve this mission. And I think altogether that we will have a lot more eyeballs on this project. Why Why did Amelia go to Kodak to look at a camera, you know, if she wasn't going to be using pictures? You know, why did the clipper vanish, but then it left behind breadcrumbs that leads us to Truck Lagoon? Why did eyewitnesses just last year tell us all that they saw these 15 Americans blindfolded, put into a truck, pulled from a four-engine silver plane, and they were taken to a hospital where they were interrogated, and then they were executed. And they sang American songs, and people heard these, and they still knew these songs. Why would these people say this if it didn't really happen? So that's what we're trying to do, is just figure it out and then leave a legacy. Because for us, you know, we're all looking at history, but when do you get a chance to actually change history, modify history? And I think that's the allure to it for me.
Okay, Jeff, you're up.
Yeah, and just to tag on to what Guy was saying, I don't, and I may be wrong, but I don't know if this has ever been done where we're asking for help. We want the public's eyes, as Guy mentioned, perhaps their expertise, if they're an expert in, like Jim's expertise in recovery or piloting or boating or just anything along those lines. Guy started this project 20 years now ago, and he was doing this solo for many, many years. And, you know, kudos to Guy, where he kind of, he let me in, and then he befriended and let the Narcos guys in, Steve and Javier and Jim. And now we've got a team of experts, but we're not experts in everything. So if we can get more eyes through the X5 adventure, that we want to do in February of 2020, I'm hoping that we can solve this mystery and ultimately repatriate these 15 bodies.
All right, Guy, it's time to plug away, sir. Where can our listeners find out more information on Expedition 5?
Thank you, Chris. I would like everyone, if you have the opportunity, to visit us at lostclipper.com/Expedition 5, the number 5. So that's lostclipper.com/expedition5. And there you can learn about our mission, our goal, and what we're putting together. And if you want to virtually participate in a live stream event on February 20th of next year, you can watch us do the actual search with these dogs and actually communicate with us via Instagram, because this will be an Instagram-only event. So you'll have to download that program, that app. And you can communicate with us, ask us questions, give us shout outs. We'll talk to you while we're doing it. And if God willing, we find human remains, if we strike and we find it, you'll actually see it real time. I mean, you just can't even get any more real than that. History happening in front of your face. How awesome is that? I mean, when do you get to actually see history books change? Because if I believe state-sponsored air piracy is an act of war. So if the Japanese attacked us on July 29th, 1938. That moves the start of World War II for America from 41 to 38. And you get to see that proof unveiled right underneath our feet. So we wish you to join us, and we really appreciate the support.
Expedition 5, exposing the secret mission to rescue Amelia Earhart. My guests tonight have been Guy Nofsinger, Jeff Riegel, Jim Janicki. Links to everything that we spoke about in the show notes. This has been a genuine pleasure, and this marks our final theory episode for this podcast. Future's bright for this case. I'm personally looking forward to the next 365 days. Gentlemen, thank you so much. All the best to all of you. And with that conversation, we decide to say goodbye to the Earhart Noonan investigation. For this podcast, anyway. Keep in mind, if you're a subscriber to our other show, Vanished Amelia Earhart, then you know we have one final theory episode to cover over there in our jury trial look at this amazing and enthralling investigation. This has been an amazing journey over the course of the last 15 years, not only for me personally, but for our entire Chasing Earhart team. Episode 80 will be short, sweet, and special, and it's coming at you soon. As for the investigation, you followed us along as we've interviewed many, many people throughout this case in every theory. It is my sincere hope that after what we've laid out here together, you've gained a better understanding of this investigation from everyone that's involved in it, and that we've been able to provide you, our listener, with a fair and balanced platform to hear every opinion in this case. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining the chase. One final episode to go. I hope you'll come back to Chasing Earhart one more time to hear our thoughts and the thoughts of some very special guests on how Amelia Earhart lived. And now, for the last time, this is Forrest Burgess.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Japanese Capture retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.